Accession number 28671, Mr. Ronald Waitman, Reel 5. Now, we're talking about your training, and you mentioned the secrecy. Tell me about the secrecy. What sort of secrecy was it?
Well, the secrecy was, of course, that radar was something which the Germans wished to know about. So everyone who went on to radar, it was drilled in them, on no account had you to talk about it, or to anyone, not even to your mothers, sweethearts, wives, or anything. And when you saw in the places where you learned things, where you were taught, you realized that you were part of something which was to defend the country. And the defense of the country was solely controlled by radar. Nobody realized that. And the number of radar stations around the country were over 1,000 of different sorts. The two I've mentioned you of CH and CHL, there was CHEL, and then it went on to types 15, 16, 17, 18, and went through to type 64, which was all different sorts of radar. But the...
Now, what sort of secrecy? I mean, what level of secrecy? Were you not allowed to talk about it to anybody, your family, or what was it?
Well, it was solely because when you were posted to a radar station, which was in some perhaps lonely part of the country, you could see the hostile aircraft that were coming in. You could see the movement of our planes going out on bombing missions. And you could see aircraft coming in that were in distress because they gave a signal out.
Hang on, the secrecy, I remember, we're still at Yatesbury.
At Yatesbury, it was drilled into you that you must in no way give any information away. It was drilled into you day in, day out. And of course...
Now, what else about the training there? I don't know whether you can go into any more detail about what you actually learned.
Well, you had to learn these huge contraptions of machines, who were very big in those days, were enormous.
Tell me, which one can you describe best, do you think?
The CHL, which is as big as this room, the inside of it, and inside was about 8 personnel. In looking, facing you was a big... the actual receiver part had 2 parts on it which revolved round, which was 360 degree sweep, and that was a distance from where you were sat of about 140, 150 miles either side of you. The next screen showed up the heights of the aircraft, which
Tell me about the set.
The set in itself, there were 2 people sat at the consoles, and they just read out a screen. One was giving readings of if there was aircraft movements of all around 360 degrees, and the other person sat next gave the height of the echo that was coming back. We call it an echo because that was the image that came back from an aircraft in the sky. And each station had a name. That name was a code word. Each radar station all had what is called areas where aircraft could move through that you couldn't plot.
Is this something you did while you were at Yatesbury?
Yes, that was drilled into you while you were at Yatesbury, that the parts of the country where there were radar stations, that was blank areas where German aircraft could come in and could not be plotted on the tubes. That was everywhere all over the country this happened. And this was where it was highly secretive that nothing like that could ever get out, what the Germans would utilize to the fullest extent. They did do unknowingly, an aircraft did slip through. Now...
But they wouldn't know.
They wouldn't know, no.
Now, what else have you learned? So the CHL radio set. Now,
and CH.
And CHL.
CH.
Now, how does CH differ?
The CH was, of course, was just one tube, and you controlled it with your left hand, with a knob which was called a goniometer, and you turn that 360 degrees, and you found if there was any aircraft, and it came up on the tube, it came up as a sort of pulse like that. Oh, and the more you steadied the pulse, when you steadied it, then you knew exactly the miles it was away from you. Now it was very true in its sort of working, but the people who could work it best were women, because a woman's hand is more steadier than a man. And they found that all the way along the line, that women as radar operators on this type of equipment were much better.
But that didn't apply to the CHL,
sir? No, the CHL was much simpler, because it just gave, as it swept around 360 degrees with a huge aerial, and that gave you the image. And of course, it was in squares, so you could report out exactly where the echo was. And of course, as it went round, so the next sweep, you could make it go faster or slower, so you get then a track. And you could follow it so easily.
Now, anything else you were learning at Yatesbury?
No. The food there was dreadful. It was awful.
Now, why was the food?
I mean, awful food.
In what way was it awful?
It was full of bloody cockroaches, for one thing. It was awful. It was vile. It was horrible. Everybody's been there. The billets themselves were good. They were very clean. And, of course, with working shift work, you allowed a great amount of leeway, that you weren't harassed by people chasing you for doing fatigues or doing anything. You were a completely separate from the station itself, because it was a very secretive unit. Now, the numbers of people that were passing through on a two-month course was about 120, both male and female. And strangely,
that's what it was, a two-month course.
Yes. Strangely may seem, the number of failures were non-existent. Everybody seemed to pass.
Now, why was that? That sounds strange.
It just seems strange, because it was a hard course. Very hard indeed. Now, when you passed out, then you were posted. And you were posted all over the country.
So you'd pass out in what, November 43?
Yeah. Now, I passed out, and my posting was to a place called Sango. You've never heard of that.
How do you spell it?
S-A-N-G-O. Sango.
G-O?
Yes, Sango. And that was the northwest tip of Scotland, near Cape Roth. A little village called Durness.
Durness, D-U...
Durness, in Sutherlandshire. Right in the northwest tip.
Now, what type of radar station was
now,
this?
That contained CHL... CHEL, which was CH Extra Low, and also at two other stations there called 7K and 9K. Now, 7K was the originating of calibration of bombing by beam. And 9K was used by Bomber Command to steer aircraft onto precision targets.
Now, tell me how that was the 7K.
Yeah. Now, they worked in threes. And from Durness, the station they worked with, one was Inverness, and the other one was Dumfries, and the other one was in Northern Ireland. And they beamed onto one another, and they were the precision that they got with that, with four beams meeting one another, you got a forecast, what they call...
Was this a G system? Or
yeah, that's right, yes, yeah. and it worked so splendid. But you were not allowed to go into these blocks at Durness. The operators worked so little, and they lived in the huts, and they had the food different from us. They were super secretive human beings. They knew nothing about them.
So the 7K radar sets, although they were there, you didn't use them?
No, we weren't allowed. You see, they had their own operators.
Did you know anything about them at
no,
the time?
No, none whatsoever. None whatsoever. Now,
what were you... So you were on the...
CHL. CHL.
Now, what was your role on the CHL set then?
I was LAC, the Lady in Aircraftsman. And the...
So what was your job on the CHL set?
Well, with being ex-air crew, they put me in charge of a certain, certain section. Because they said you had experience of looking after people, even though I wasn't a corporal or anything. And it was an all-male station, there were no females. Now, that station was extremely busy, because it had huge amounts of aircraft coming in from America via Reykjavik in Ireland, and used to come down in flights of 20 and 30 Super Fortresses and Liberators. And we all had to look after them, that they came at a certain bearing. Now, up there, you have tremendous winds and dreadful problems of storms. And also you have...
Now, tell me about the storms.
Well, the storms were very vigorous. And the aerial, when it got to a speed of 60 miles an hour, they were all fastened down with horses. They couldn't move because, you see, when you get winds of a huge area as big as this room moving with forced winds of 60, as it got out of the wind, it pushed it like the very devil. It forced it against the machinery that was turning it. So it caused enormous strain, so they had to be fastened at a certain angle into the wind. Now, when this happened, that station was unserviceable, because it was only beaming onto one bearing. That was all. So you're out of action. At the same time, of course, there was always movement of aircraft coming in from America in violent weather. And we had to manage the searchlight. That searchlight was angled at a certain bearing, up into the sky, and low cloud, of course, was useless because your beam just reflected back; it wouldn't go through it, so it was useless. But we had to do it, and that was an awful problem. Another thing
Why were you looking for the U.S. aircraft?
Because they were all coming down in batches, and they had to be watched that they didn't stray, because what we found, you see, in those atmospheres where you got the aurora borealis, which played havoc with our screens, the aircraft sometimes would come down, and they would suddenly veer at an angle into the Atlantic. In that case, we would say what was happening. From Stornoway, there'd be a Spitfire would be scrambled to try and contact them. If they couldn't contact them, that aircraft would go off our screens, and it would never be seen again. It would run out of petrol and crash in the Atlantic somewhere. That was a frightful problem, and we used to think some poor devil there is going to their death that they don't know anything about. Because they had this movement of the what they call it, and running out of blessings.
Now, what was a typical shift like on the CHL set?
Well, of course, depending on the type of day or night, I take it from 6 a.m. was always an adventurous time because of the remnants of all the military aircraft coming down from Reykjavik in Iceland through to Wharton. They were all American Liberators and Super Fortresses, and there were the remnants of them that perhaps got behind through problems of engine failures in Newfoundland So they were in threes and fours and fives. So that was always very busy for the first 2 hours. After that, you had a tremendous amount of Sunderland aircraft utilising what is called box searches for submarines. They carried out this box search north, south, east and west in a slowly diminishing sort of box. Next to them was another Sunderland, and you had to keep track of these. They were down to about 250 feet in appalling weather, too, because submarine activity was very busy in that area, with Scapa Flow being 53 miles away. I did point out to you that we had serious problems on the traces regarding the Aurora Borealis, which in those days could not be blotted out. Now it can. But also we had strange things that happened, which we thought were spurious echoes. And we did report these. They appeared on the trace at a certain bearing. As the trace swept round the next sweep, there was a similar sort of echo appeared some 150 miles away. And we couldn't understand it. We logged it as a spurious echo, because you get these things happening in the ionosphere. But the ministry then cottoned that something was happening. And so we had to record it very, very diligently. And it was given the title of Nomad, which is a wanderer. And it was only affecting those people in the northern part of Scotland where this was occurring. And we didn't know anything about it, I didn't, until I would say about 5 or 6 years ago, when I picked it up from the squadron leader, Mike Dean. He said, "Ron, you had this lot." I said, "Yes." He said, "You know what they were looked at? As UFOs." Because in those days, there's no idea what was transmitting in the atmosphere. And they were an unknown object. But I thought, well, in those days, we laughed about it and said, it's not German because it's going too bloody fast. It was going over 1,000 miles an hour, of course. But that was one little item which remains with me. Another one up there was that in the lock next to us, they suddenly descended one morning, about 10 loads of naval chaps with lorries, loaded with planks. And the commanding officer drew us all together and said, "We must not go near this camp." It was about 4 miles away from us. It was extremely secretive. We wondered what was going on. And it was only through the locals that we found out. The Navy built a huge contraption like a ship. And it was in the shape of a German battleship. And they built this in the side of the lock. It wasn't until about a week after we were told that we were extensive activity of lower flying for 3 days. In the end, live bombs would be discharged very near to us. We didn't realise, because in those days you didn't. You hadn't access to knowledge of what was taking place. But it was a build-up to the bombing of German battleships, which were in the locks of Norway.
The turbids.
Yes, that's right, yes. And of course, the turbids end was turned over by Lancaster's heaving stuff out from 14,000 to 15,000 feet. They turned it over. But this was extremely busy because it was low flying, and it was carried out by American aircraft from a aircraft carrier that stood off about 40 miles from us. But also they were interlocked with Mosquito aircraft coming in at high speed. They didn't drop large bombs. They just caused havoc with the ship that was built. They blew it to smithereens in the end. The local people had a field day, because all the planks, they built that many outhouses, because they said, "Well, it's yours. Do what you want." The firewood and God knows what they utilised them. But it was a marvellous thing for them. And the naval chaps, they disappeared, of course, and that was it. So that was a peculiar thing that happened. While we were up there, you know, Winston Churchill used to come up there.
Tell us about his visit.
The Cape Wrath Hotel he used to come to. And he used to come, we didn't know he was there, until he suddenly appeared in the village. He had I saw only one person with him, and he always had his cigar, of course, and he'd amble around the shops, he'd buy things, and he'd speak to you and ask where you came from, and he always wished you luck, and the luck, he always walked. And the Cape Roth Hotel was about, I would say, about 2 miles from Durness in itself, and he just walked over a rugged path, but he did an enormous amount of painting when he was up there. And we used to go to the Cape Roth Hotel. There was security. They knew that we were forces because we were in uniform, of course, but not to the extent that it would, as it would be now. It was very simple, and I think he wanted it that way, but that was...
it was a recreational visit. I mean, he was just there to relax.
It was a way of relaxing from the commitments of war, and that was it.
Now, anything else you remember about your time at Durness?
Yes. We used to shoot the red deer with 303 rifles for food, because the cooks themselves thought it was marvellous to have venison. And, of course, it was strictly illegal. It was all right where the bullet went into the stag or hind or whatever it was we shot, but as he came out, of course, it caused a great aperture, because he took ribs and God knows with it. Anything it touched, it splattered and caused a problem. But we had venison for days and days and days. So that was one thing. The carcasses, I often wonder what happened to them. They were discharged into the sea at sort of the dead of night at some convenient part away from the camp. The camp in itself, the billets were extremely cold. You had one stove in the middle.
Well, it was just hot accommodation, wasn't it?
Yes, just Nissen huts. And it was extremely cold. And we took it in rotation to sleep near the fire. You slept 1 week, there'd be about four of you, and then there'd be six at another part of the building for the rest of the week, and you had extra blankets because it was damn cold up there, very cold indeed. The morale of people was excellent. The local people took tours. We used to get them to come into films. And another thing, I was up there for New Year. That was a fantastic thing. I came off duty at 10 o'clock. The whole camp was invited into the village where some church had been taken over, the pews had been all moved, and we got there about, it would be about 11 o'clock, we walked down, and there'd be about, I'd say about 180 of the RAF chaps. All was very quiet and serene up to about quarter to midnight, and then the males disappeared. They came back again, festooned with eagle's feathers, with bagpipes, and they gathered round the room. And up till then, there had been no intoxicating liquor. It had been tea and coffee, etc., and sandwiches. At 5 minutes to midnight, a huge chappie came in with a great gong and counted down to midnight. And then, for 2 hours, the fiddlers, the melodeons, they played like merry owl, and the hooch came out, which was from local distilleries. They'd made it themselves. So consequently, I would say that easy 75% of the camp in the morning was absolutely intoxicated because it was lethal stuff. We all said bloody never again because we were ill. The CO didn't reprimand us or anything. He said, well, the local village have tried their best to help us in sort of a situation that you're away from home. But that was another occasion of joy of Scottish hospitality.
How long were you there for? You were there from what? 11th of what? Was it 43? I've forgotten already.
Yeah, I went there in, I think it was the end of 43, was it?
November 43.
And when I disappeared from that area in May 44.
So anything else happened in that 5 or 6 months?
Well, I didn't just remain at that station. I was along the coast at another station called Betty Hill.
Now, tell me about that station.
Now, Betty Hill had WAFs there, which were a great aspiration to the local, to the chaps, because there was shortage of female. And, of course, the dancers, they had a very riotous. The shifts were all 50% male and 50% female. The females were far more efficient than the males. I stood out a mile with regard to operation and procedure. And, of course, Betty Hill was much nearer to Scapa Flow than we were, so there was always raids by my German aircraft, and, of course, they always meandered round the coastline, and they did discharge various small bombs at the radar, but they never caused any problems. From Petty Hill, I fluctuated when there and Sango. Then
now, was it the same radar set?
Same radar, CHL. Yeah, yes. I went from there down to Inverness, which is our headquarters, a place called Bunkeroo House. From there, I went to another radar station near Aberdeen called School Hill, CHL again, which was very active at below Aberdeen, and the vast number of German aircraft were always meandering about, so your hostile activity was very, very busy.
And did you actually move there, or was that just a detachment?
Just a detachment. There were three of us went on this detachment. And then I went back to Bunkeroo House. From Bunkeroo House, I went right down to the south coast, to Worth Matravers near Swanage.
So that's in May?
That was in May. And I was crewed up. This is 40.
Now that's Worth?
It's Worth Matravers. Worth Matravers. Travers. Near Swanage. This area of Worth Matravers consisted of a vast number of radar apparatus, and also next to it was a place called Renscombe Downs, where I was put there with many others to crew up for the invasion of Western Europe.
And what preparations were you making? What do you mean by crew up?
Well, I was with a Canadian crew, and there were 54, 56 of us, cooks, MT drivers, military police, various officers and technical officers, radar mechanics, the whole lot as a combined force.
And what was the force called?
The course. No.
What was it called? The group?
Oh, it was under 60 group. 60 group, which is a controlling thing for radar. Everything on radar went under 60 group. Worth Matravers was an area which was controlled by the invasion forces, because everything in that area were controlled by them.
So it was 60 group at Worth Matravers, but what were you forming, the subunit?
We were forming all radar installations have an MAMES number, which is Amateur Experimental Station, and they're all given a number. All radar units, whether they consist of 10, 5, or 200, they all are given that number. I can't remember the number.
It's a long time. So you formed this radar unit at Worth Matravers?
Yeah. In the subsidiary part of Renscombe Downs, of course, which is near to it. Now, you're given extensive training there on bayonet practice, on firing machine guns, besides crewing up, and you were to sort...
So tell me a bit more about this military training. What was it like?
The military training was very active, because you realised that you were going into a situation of confronting the enemy. With no date, nobody had, but we're told that it was in the immediate future. The immediate future was about 10 days after that, after we got there. So it was extensive training with regard to looking after yourselves, to have various documentations on you and know what the hell you were doing, really, your body hygiene and all the rest of it.